Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Texans training camp is happening now. Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Happy Monday to all of you. Wake up! Wake up! We appreciate you getting up with us. We are with you this morning as Texans training camp. Practice number 8 today at 9:30. Bill O'Brien meeting with the media at 9. I would imagine In the Loop will have it a little later on, sometime in the 10 o'clock hour for you. Taking up the Texans training camp live, and things are popping out at NRG Stadium, and Houston sports are, well, Wednesday and Thursday and Friday of last week was better than Saturday and Sunday were, but whatever, we've got sports back, it's all good, and it's nice to be with all of you. My name is Sean Pendergast, and his name is Seth Payne. Good morning, Seth, how was your weekend?
Good morning, it was very good. There was lots of news this weekend.
Yeah, it was a newsy weekend.
It wasn't so great on the Astros and Rockets fronts, but the Rockets I'm okay with because, look, frankly, we got super greedy super fast here in Houston to a point where it was starting to make me a little bit nervous. Everybody was acting like it was no big deal that Russell Westbrook was out. Like, oh, hey, you're facing Chris Paul and the Oklahoma City Thunder, who we knew would be a tough opponent even with Russell Westbrook potentially. And Russell Westbrook is out. It's not going to be smooth sailing all the time.
Yeah, but you should be able to inbound a basketball with under a minute left. Like, I would agree with you wholeheartedly if they'd lost, you know, 110-98 or something like that. They should be up 3-0 right now. That was an infuriating ending to that basketball game.
It was an infuriating ending, but I think the fact that he even got to the ending, and this, like, I feel dirty saying this.
Say it. But say it. Let's get dirty on a Monday morning. Let's go.
It feels dirty because it's so easy to say, but the open threes have got to start falling.
Yeah.
And they've had over 40 wide open threes every single time they've played Oklahoma City so far. They're not getting them from Eric Gordon at all. And they're not getting them from James Harden as much as you'd like. And it's as simple as that. It doesn't come down to that moment if they're just not so cold. And Sean, the reason it feels so dirty is because we've got the closeout game from a couple of years back where you know it's perfectly possible and it's a scenario that could happen where you miss 25 straight three-point attempts.
Yes.
And like, after the game, D'Antoni saying, well, eventually the shots will start to fall. Like, no, Mike. Mike, we remember 2 years ago when the shots didn't fall when we needed them to fall.
Yeah. Eric Gordon, 4-for-26. Eric Gordon, when I watch the way this team's shooting the basketball, particularly Eric Gordon, Seth, I don't even really think about this series. And maybe it's a dangerous way to think because now the Thunder have a little bit of life to them. The fact that they not only lost the game, but they seem to resuscitate Chris Paul in overtime in the process is fairly infuriating as well. But I think big picture with this team, look, this is not a team that if they win in the first round, they get knocked out of the playoffs, it's going to feel like a successful season. They need to make a deep run or else they're probably going to be, there will certainly be a change in head coach, I think, and there's going to be a level of frustration among the fan base that they're still kind of stuck in the mud. They need Eric Gordon to start hitting shots if they're going to do anything. They'll win this series with Eric Gordon not making shots, even without Russell Westbrook, if he were to rest the rest of the series. I think they win this series in 6 games max because the Thunder got about as good a game as they're going to get from their 3-guard trio in Game 3, and it took them overtime and a ton of Rocket mistakes and bad shooting by the Rockets just to win the game in overtime. But they ain't beating the Lakers or the Clippers with Eric Gordon shooting this way.
They're not, and I feel that's going to come back. I'm okay with that. You know, we know how the pendulum swings with the shooting like this, and the fact that they're getting wide open threes. This isn't like teams of the past with the Rockets sometimes, where they got tired and they just started jacking up threes. Mm-hmm. You know, with the kind of the excuse that, hey, that's what we do. No, they're driving, they're creating open looks, so that's there. I think when it was 102-97 with a minute to go,
yeah,
that's where, hey, we've been gushing about your guys' defense. How about you don't let CP3 have a super easy layup?
Yeah.
How about you don't have Steven Adams do what everybody said, you know, big people were going to do versus you? And then, like you said, how about you inbound a pass?
Yeah.
Which didn't end up being touched by Adams. It looked like it from the one angle, but
No, so that's the thing to me is if you just inbound a basketball, then you get into a free throw shooting contest and you win that game. They didn't do a very good job of closing out on threes either. Seth, when they were up 102-97, I didn't have a huge problem with the Chris Paul layup to cut it to three, only because that's at the stage of the game. You're now with about 50 seconds left in the game, willing to give up a two to then get the ball and get down there and you know, go maybe get fouled or go get another bucket or whatever the case may be. It was, to me, the killer was the three by Gilgeous-Alexander in the corner.
House didn't close out.
Yeah. House is going to help out on defense. There's already two of his teammates in the lane helping out on that. So that to me was the real killer shot right there. And they didn't close out well on threes. You're right. Their defensive game, which in game two was an A. I mean, their defensive game, this was not just OKC's missing shots. Like, the Rockets looked engaged and active on defense. Look, it wasn't what Rocket Ball has been the last few years, where at times it becomes a C- or a D. It was fine, but it wasn't great. And with no Russell Westbrook, you're going to need to be good to great on defense against these guys.
I guess I disagreed with what seemed to be the majority opinion in Houston that, wow, this is the best defense the Rockets have ever played. I think that there's some recency bias there, because in 2018 versus the Warriors, that team was playing some hellacious defense.
Yeah.
They were limiting one of the most potent offenses we've ever seen. And over the second half of that season, they were one of the very best defenses in the league. You know, in the bubble, in the games that mattered over the first half of the bubble, the first four or five games, the Rockets were the fifth best defense.
Mm-hmm.
So they were good. They were vastly improved. But I don't think that all of a sudden this is the best defense the Rockets have ever had.
Yeah.
But they do have to look like they did in the first and second game.
Yeah. So the Rockets, they lose on Saturday, 3 o'clock tip today. I love that. 3 o'clock tip today for the Rockets. Did I say Astros? I meant Rockets. Rockets.
Basically the same thing.
They're a team from Houston that gets paid lots of money. Game four, 3 o'clock tip today. Seth, the other reason I'm like, man, the Rockets need to make a run here is because, like, big picture, I'm going, because they're going to have to deal with Luka Doncic for the next 12 years. Like, they better make hay right now while they've got James Harden and Russell Westbrook in their prime, because this damn Luka Doncic guy is going to be a real pain in the ass for the next decade. Did you watch that yesterday? Holy crap.
he's going to be a pain in the butt. Now, let's remember, Dallas was supposedly, now there's the Jazz, actually. The Jazz were more worried about the matchup with the Rockets. Doncic is going to be a pain in the ass for a long time to come. Don't do this, though. Don't start thinking too far into the future about, oh, well, James Harden's going to be, you know, retiring within a few years, and then you have to worry about Doncic. They'll figure it out. They'll find. We can worry about that later.
Yeah, no, it's just on the heels of what Doncic did yesterday, which was honestly, like, I don't like to go into, I don't like to hit superlatives a ton, because the older I get, the more games I've seen, and I really have to sit back and think as to, if I'm going to attach a superlative to this, am I being honest about it, or am I just being hyperbolic for radio's sake? It was, when you factor in, they were down 21 points, he came in with a sprained ankle, and he put up a 40-point triple-double as a 21-year-old. That is, and he hit a buzzer beater to win the game.
It is
one of the most amazing performances I've ever seen in the playoffs.
Montrezl Harrell might want to shy away from calling him a bitch-ass white boy.
Yeah.
He reportedly did. There was some lip reading done there. You know, I saw that. That was kind of a big story, I guess, over the weekend, because it was presented. There are all these headlines where it showed Montrezl Harrell in Luka Doncic's face, and it said, calls him a bitch-ass white boy.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you look at the actual clip, it's Montrezl Harrell backpedaling on defense,
yeah,
far away from Luka Doncic. And it's not clear that that's what he said. I mean, he is He is a white boy from Dallas, so yeah. I feel like bitch-ass white boy is an accurate assessment of a lot of the people I know from Dallas in general.
Well, he's not so, originally from Dallas.
If they choose to reside there right now.
Fair enough.
If the shoe fits, wear it.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I was the same way. I'm like, oh, I haven't seen this yet, so I looked up the video yesterday, especially after Luka hung a 40 burger on them, and after Montrezl Harrell had only 2 points and one rebound in the game. I'm like, oh, I need to go back and watch this. I didn't get to see it in real time the first time, and I watch it. I'm like, he's practically back at his end of the court when he's saying it. Like he's like a good 40 feet away from Luka. This is not caustic or acerbic at all. Well, I want fights. I want belligerence.
The question is, okay, you know, people will say, well, what if Luka said that to Montrez? And I'm like, well, why would he call Montrez a bitch-ass white boy? That doesn't make any sense
at all.
He's
colorblind.
Come on, people. No wonder he's
turning the ball over so much. He's colorblind. All right. So we're off and running on a Monday. The Texans are back at practice today. I'll give you my thoughts on yesterday's practice. I was out there yesterday at the bottom of the hour. Meanwhile, Seth touched on it, the Astros. It was fun on Friday when they were 15-10 and were doing the show. They're 15-13 now. They get swept this weekend. But we're going to spend the next segment counting our blessings for the Astros. So stay with us. You're listening to Payne and Pendergast. So the Astros this weekend, we were so excited on Friday morning. Like, look at this 8-game winning streak. The pitching has been lights out lately, the starting pitching. They swept up a pretty good team in Colorado. They were 13-8 coming into that series with the Astros. I don't know that Colorado's won a game since the beginning of that series, by the way.
No, they definitely haven't, because currently the Astros sit at not having won a game against a team that's currently over 500.
Ah, okay, so the Rockies are now under 500. See, that is a bit of a Fugazi stat to me, because the Astros are a big reason why the Rockies are under 500.
Yeah.
Maybe the biggest
Rockies
reason, yeah.
Whatever,
yeah.
Small sample size, all that, but currently they are 0-8 against teams that currently have a record above 500.
So they're, okay, well, that's an interesting stat. They're like the anti-Rockets, because the Rockets coming into the playoffs, the Rockets finished the season with the best record against teams with records over 500 in the NBA, or maybe against playoff teams. The Rockets were like 18-11 against playoff teams this year. Some maybe with like 4 games to go before the last 3 games where they just kind of cashed it in. So the Rockets are actually a team that plays really well against good teams. Bodes well for the postseason. The Astros are lamb killers. That's what they are.
The Rockets are like the Tom Herman Cougars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically. Except without being underdogs in those matchups.
Yeah.
Brett Dolan actually took to Twitter with some heat over this.
What did he say? Former Astros play-by-play guy, Brett Dolan?
Yeah. He said right now the Astros are the fifth grader who takes everybody's lunch at lunch money to elementary school. Then he gets on the bus and goes home where the neighbor middle schooler pounds him and takes all the money back.
Just picturing,
the bully.
I know, I'm picturing Machado and Tatis just like mollywhopping cranky on the bus.
I'm sitting here, I'm watching these games, and I honestly, even yesterday, 3 days into it, I couldn't get over the fact that this is the San Diego Padres.
Yeah, dude.
Just unbelievable.
That's a good baseball team.
Tatis is good for baseball, man.
God, Tatis, how about the catch he had on Springer?
I know. Oh, yeah, I like him, except when he's robbing Springer or Altuve. Altuve is finally getting it going, and then except Tatis has to pee all over his birthday cake.
Well, let's get into that a little bit here, Seth. So the Astros have lost 3 in a row, but here there is good news, Astro fans. There is good news here. I'm here to talk you off the ledge. I know 15-13 is not where we all anticipated being right now. However, we didn't anticipate Justin Verlander, Roberto Osuna, Alex Bregman. You know, Brantley's back, but he was on the IL. All the Yordan Alvarez done for the year. We didn't anticipate that either. So they're 15-13 right now. The expanded playoffs are a real gift, because they are 4.5 games ahead of the Rangers for second place in the division. Need I remind you that if you are in first or second place in your division, you are automatically, it doesn't matter what your record is, you are automatically in the postseason. They are 4.5 games in front of the Rangers for the second place spot in the AL West. Now they're 4.5 games back of the A's for first place. So I don't think they're winning the division necessarily, but their playoff probability right now, Seth, the probability of the Astros at least getting to one of those best of three wild card round series is 96.5%. So we're going to get postseason baseball. Like, as wonky as it is right now, as uneven as it feels right now, as much as they're relying on all these rookies both in the rotation and in the bullpen, as rickety as the whole thing feels, 96.5% chance the Astros make the postseason, and I think that number feels accurate to me. Even though they lost three in a row to the Padres, it feels accurate because their schedule the rest of the way are the exact type of teams that the Astros like to play. Crappy baseball teams. They're going to lamb-kill their way to a second-place finish in the AL West. Bam.
Sean, some people see a glass as 96.5% full. Sometimes I see it as 3.5% empty.
Of course you
and,
do.
And what are the chances of that 3.5% chance that they don't make the playoffs expands? Not very likely. Yeah. I feel pretty – at this point, it all becomes, all right, how healthy and how on pace with their normal selves can they be by the time they hit the playoffs? Yeah. Bregman's out for 3 weeks. That doesn't make me feel any better. So, you know, Bregman, who had his traditional slow start, then got it going, but now has this hamstring. We know hamstrings. If somebody says they're going to be out 3 weeks with a hamstring, mentally I figure, all right, 5 weeks, hopefully, because I don't want him coming back after 3 weeks and then being gimpy. So let's say a month before he comes back, but then you're smack dab into the playoffs by that point.
Okay, let me give you some items that'll make you feel better, I hope. I just laid out that the stat nerds think there's a 96.5% chance they make the postseason. Kyle Tucker, Seth, I don't want to jinx it.
Oh, yeah.
Kyle Tucker's starting to hit. His OPS has gone up by 200 points on this road trip. He was 577 when they left Houston. By the way, they're back in Houston now to play the Angels over the next few days. He was 577 OPS on base plus slugging when they left Houston. He returns home with a 7, that's not great, but it's 200 points higher, a 777 OPS. He's starting to hit the baseball a little bit.
Well, yeah, and the trajectory is very good. He's been much better than a 770 OPS, you know, in getting it up to that
point.
That's
right.
And I think so much about Tucker is what we know about prospects, right? It takes time. They need steady at-bats. And maybe instead of Abraham Toro, you could have had Kyle Tucker in there a few of those times early on. But it also is the circumstance versus think about when Bregman came up in 2016 and he was struggling so hard. That was a different time for the Astros. The expectations weren't so great and there wasn't as much pressure. Where with Tucker, every at bat,
you're playing
like,
big games all the time.
Letting the team down, man. What the hell are you doing?
That's right.
And yeah, he's starting to look a lot more like what they thought he would. Now, Forrest Whitley is not, but that's a whole other topic altogether.
I'm staying with the positive. Altuve started hitting again this weekend, too.
Well, no, but the thing about that, though, that's a positive in my mind because we still can look at this ERA, this team ERA, which took a hit the last few days, but still the Astros pitching. You know, if you had told me before the season that it would be where it is right now, I would have assumed, okay, well, Forrest Whitley must come along. It's not with all these youngsters and what have you. But it's been different. It's been a youth movement. So, this has been fun, man. If it weren't for all of the cheating scandal, fog and haze that's over the team right now, I'd be having a lot more fun with it because it feels like a scrappy, different sort of Astros team.
Yeah.
These last few years, it's been a little bit of a, all right, they're the best team in baseball. Can they pull it off and can they not get upended in the World Series? Now it's very much like it feels like they're fighting for their lives.
I think you're 100% spot on with what you said a couple minutes ago. To me, the most accurate thing you just said was that it's not about what their record is at the end. I'm paraphrasing what you said, but not about what their record is at the end of the year. It's what they look like heading into the playoffs. What does this team look like? What do the last couple weeks of the season look like? What does the roster look like? Is Justin Verlander part of this? The snapshot of what they look like on September 27th or whatever the last day of the season is, that's the most important thing with this team. As long as they're in the playoffs, obviously. You know, just get in the playoffs and then worry about the rest later. All right.
Yeah.
A new Houston Texan finally got on the field. Has me pretty fired up about what I saw with the offense yesterday at practice. We will dig into what I saw. Seth will react to it. We'll do that next. Also, a future Hall of Famer becomes available. The Texans' name mixed in with him. Not so sure. We'll talk about that as well. Nice long segment next. You're listening to Payne and Pendergast. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Monday. Hope you had a great weekend. The Texans were back at it yesterday in pads, doing a doing as much hitting as they're going to do. It does not sound like we will see any actual tackling at any point in a Texans preseason here, Seth.
Oh, yeah. There was an article about the Steelers I saw this weekend where Tomlin has actually had some full contact, full tackle drills.
Yeah.
I think...
That feels on brand for Tomlin.
It sounded like the brand new version, whatever's allowed. It wasn't the Oklahoma drill, but it was like one step shy of an Oklahoma drill.
Okay.
Some kind of linebacker's drill.
Pushing the envelope. Nice.
Where they tackled. Yeah, that's Tomlin goes through these cycles where he feels like he needs to reset the toughness of his team.
Mm-hmm.
So he like goes super hardcore old school for a while, and then he backs off, and then he goes through another phase where he does that, which how I feel about this. I think that it just depends on what the individual coach and the individual team. Some coaches do really well having more contact. Other coaches do extremely well having very little contact at all. And it just, it's at the end of the day, okay, what works for you?
Yeah, Seth, I don't know what other teams are doing when it comes to health of players. Like, I don't follow all the other training camps closely enough. And Ben, this is probably a pretty good point to start up the mood music here for the practice report from yesterday. I think if you're... Similar to what we were just talking about with the Astros, quite honestly, as you and I were just saying, the main thing for the Astros is that they just need to be healthy and have the team that they want on the field getting ready to take part in the postseason on September 27th. That all the other goals and things like that, be damned. Just get into the postseason and be healthy and ready to go. Now, the Texans aren't playing real games right now like the Astros are. But I do think that similarly, if you were to ask O'Brien, like, where does health of your team fit in amongst all your goals to accomplish here in training camp? I think it's number one. I think it's a number one. He's already got his pretty much the first layer of his depth chart is set almost in stone. And even though he's got a bunch of new pieces on offense, they're veteran pieces. Deshaun Watson is a quarterback where I think you probably feel like, look, Deshaun's going to acclimate to anybody. He's got his whole offensive line back. The way they're handling training camp, Seth, for J.J. Watt, who was out there in pads yesterday, but really other than just stretching drills, didn't do much. Will Fuller, again, in pads, stretched, worked out off to the side like J.J. did. Gerrion Conley's been in and out of practice the last couple days. He was out there yesterday. He's healthy. Brandon Cooks finally did some 11-on-11 work yesterday. We'll get to him. To me, O'Brien and the way he's handled this team in the preseason – and the analytics that he gives us a little bit of a window into, you even asked him about it last week where he gets these printouts now of where certain guys are. What was the fastest that A.J. Moore ran? Well, he ran 21 miles an hour as a gunner on a play. We got to lay back a little bit on A.J. Moore. Like, they get that granular with the detail. It is very, very evident that this team being a fully healthy unit going into Kansas City on September 10th is the number one goal of this team right now.
It did. I always like those mile per hour stats whenever I still don't know what any of them mean.
No.
It always sounds disappointingly slow, actually. Like, I like to think of these guys as at times running as fast as cheetahs. So when I hear 20 miles an hour, I'm like, I guess I couldn't outrun a cheetah. Probably not even a lynx or anything.
Here's where 21 miles an hour sounds really fast to me.
Yeah.
I've been doing more work on the treadmill lately as I've been losing more and more weight.
Yeah.
And when I put the treadmill at 5 miles per hour, I'm like, holy crap. Like, this is exhausting. And 21 miles an hour is four times that.
Now put it up to 15 miles per hour.
Right.
And think about running that speed for 4 minutes or so, approximately to run a 4 minute mile. It's absurd.
No, it's absurd. It's ridiculous. The more absurd thing is that I am half the genetic makeup of somebody who does that at a collegiate level.
Like, yeah, I know. Yeah,
your
daughter
happen?
Actually can do all those things.
Yes, she does. It's amazing.
Those damn kids. Yeah. Now, O'Brien talked a little bit about the testing they did when they came back. They did test their quad strength and their hamstring strength, and he didn't go into great detail about it. But I do like that they're in this really weird year where they couldn't monitor guys and really figure it out. I think they're going to learn a lot of things. A lot of these teams will learn about exactly how to prepare for training camp in a normal year. Because in a normal year, you have all these OTAs and off-season conditioning programs and everything, and then they turn the players loose for like 5 or 6 weeks. It's really dumb the way the timing is set up. And some of them just don't do as good a job of it, but I think coaches always just have to assume, all right, you guys are coming back in shape. I think this year it's been a little bit different, and hopefully for the best. I mean, look, Lamar Jackson's working through some kind of groin issue right now.
I don't wish injury on anybody, but if I were talking to Lamar Jackson's groin, I would say, take your time, buddy. I would say wait till week three to get well. You know, just make sure that it's about the long play here. It's a marathon,
that's
not
right.
a sprint.
Yeah, that's yeah. like they don't really need you until
right.
week three.
Right,
if you have any faith or trust in your coaches and your backups, then maybe, you know, give them a chance to prove themselves.
Yeah, let RG3 do his thing for the first couple weeks of the season, buddy.
That's... Anything other than that is really selfishness and really signs of a bloated ego from a promising first couple seasons.
Yeah, Lamar Jackson's groin. Don't let your bloated ego get in the way of things here. Absolutely.
I'm tired of having a bloated groin. Myself. This is more of a, I'd like to be able to cross my legs like a normal person.
It's a big problem. No, you're right. Absolutely. So, Seth, yesterday we finally got a look at Brandon Cooks in 11-on-11 drills, and I have to say, it was pretty sweet. He has not done much in practice other than the individual receiver drills that they do the first 20 minutes or so each day, the walkthrough stuff. This was his first padded practice where he's participated in 11-on-11. They've been handling him with care. If the Cooks that they're going to get in 2020 is the Cooks that we saw at practice, pretty good stuff. During the during some of the one-on-one drills, he went up and made contested catches over Vernon Hargraves and Bradley Roby on some sort of deep crossers. It was really good stuff. He caught a touchdown during the 11-on-11 portion of the practice from Deshaun Watson. I'm pretty excited to watch Will Fuller and Brandon Cooks do their thing together on the field this year. It was a good practice for Cooks yesterday.
I think with Cooks, the first thing you think of immediately is, okay, this ability to catch the deep ball and all that blazing speed. But I think that just like with Will Fuller, a lot of his most exciting plays are going to come on crossing routes. Now, because he's not as adept as Will Fuller is at scaring a defensive back into, you know, covering his ass on the back end and then just sitting down and executing a crossing route. But he is pretty good at it, and he's not afraid to go over the middle. That's also when we're going to be our most nervous, though, because we know he's got these concussion histories, or this history of concussions, and on some of the hits over the middle, I'm going to be really holding my breath this year until he, you know, until he shakes the cobwebs out and we feel like, okay, those were just freak concussions.
Yeah,
fingers crossed.
None of the plays that made me go, wow, about Brandon Cooks in practice yesterday, Seth, were just straight go routes where he beat a guy down the field. He's going to do some of that this year in the regular season because that is one of his superhero strengths. But the plays that were wow plays for him were the two that I just described against Hargraves and Roby. Those were contested. The one against Roby, he went up and got it against Roby. Now, some people may look at it and go, okay, well, the flip side of that is there's your $10 million cornerback getting beat in practice. My point is that Roby had pretty good coverage on the guy. But Cooks just went up and made a play. It was one of those rare plays where I felt pretty good about both guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and Deshaun Watson's touch on the deep ball is a nice thing to have. I'm going to be on in Buffalo radio later this morning, and I'm trying to figure out what exactly I'm going to say about Josh Allen.
They love you up there.
They do. Well, because I grew up in the area, and so when I go on, there's some of the guys up there, some of the radio guys up there covered me when I was in high school, so it's just like a nice old reunion.
Is it ever since you called in as an actual caller to the show up there that they like you so much?
I think they're flattered that I tried to call in. I tried to call in as an actual caller, and I was super excited to go on, and the call screener nixed me, just rejected me, yeah. Because I made the mistake of saying I was calling from Houston, and this was before. You know, sometimes you get the caller from the city you're about to play, and you're like, all right, this guy's just going to troll us or whatever. Yep. It wasn't like that.
Yep. One more observation on Cooks, and this is more of an off-the-field observation, and I think Seth plays into some of the reason why Brandon Cooks is here with the Houston Texans. And I'm actually going to ask O'Brien about this today in his press conference at 9 o'clock. Pretty cool moment during 11-on-11. Isaiah Coulter, the rookie wide receiver, ran a go route directly down the right sideline, right in front of all of us in the media, ran a go route, and it was well covered. It was another rookie covering him, Chesley, I think is his last name. And it was a corner who was kind of in Coulter's pocket the whole way, kind of grabbing a little bit at the jersey and tugging, and Coulter really couldn't get free. And the ball kind of just, you know, the ball was overthrown in part because Coulter couldn't break loose. He couldn't get open. Cooks calls Coulter over to him on the sideline, and the two of them have a conversation for a good 4 or 5 minutes in which I couldn't hear the conversation, and even if I could, I don't know if I can share what was said. But you could tell that Cooks was showing Coulter little tricks of the trade. You know what I mean? Little tricks to either get free, I think tricks to maybe Coulter better position his body so that if his jersey does get tugged, the referee is actually going to be able to see it and it'll get called. And I thought it was a cool moment because Cooks did it proactively. One, it wasn't that Coulter walked over to Cooks and said, what can I do differently? Cooks called Coulter over. And I always think that's a cool thing to me when veteran guys like that are voluntarily and proactively giving rookies advice, maybe because there's a code in the NFL and also because you obviously want your team to be the best it can be. But Seth, I'm always impressed by players that do that because, let's face it, the perfect plan for Isaiah Coulter is for him to turn into something on this rookie deal of his. And if that's the case, then it could very well be that Brandon Cooks doesn't make his $12 or $13 million a couple years from now.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I guess.
Why read too much into that?
No, because I don't, I think, yes, you do, but it's not like you're alone in that, because I hear people say that a lot. And I guess just if you put yourself in that situation, I don't know, like a position meeting room is a kind of place where it's like a collegial place if it's a good atmosphere and there's a good culture there. And if you're a good guy that just wants to help out younger people, you get to that age when you're 30 years old in the NFL, or even when you're 28, 29, 30, sometimes it starts to feel like you would in normal life when you're like 55. And you just, there's a part of you that feels like you need to give back and help young people out and all that. So I think that's part of it. And then part of it is just simple confidence. That, look, Brandon Cooks isn't going to feel threatened by a young guy that might get better because he feels confident enough in his ability. And I think part of it, too, is that as you get older, that's one of the things you provide as a veteran player. The fact that maybe your reps need to be limited or maybe you're a little bit more injury prone, a coach that cares about culture will look at your ability to help out the younger guys and bring them along as a positive. Like, that's a check. That's as good as a really good 40 time in some respects.
Well, I 100% think that's one of the reasons Cooks is here.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's one of the reasons why they traded a second round pick for him and took on his salary. His salary this year is actually very reasonable for the Texans. It's only $8 million. But it goes up to 12 and 13 the next couple years. I think this is part of the calculus with Cooks is he's a guy who's willing to help younger players, good teammate, all the things that, you know, all the DTS stuff that O'Brien talks about.
There's also, when it comes to trying to have a culture on a team, there can be a kind of a cancerous attitude at times where some teams, it becomes almost like a too cool for school mentality, where guys feel like, yeah, I'm a pro and I know what's up, and they don't geek out about football or baseball or whatever it is the way you think they might. Mm-hmm. And that's a pervasive. I've been on a couple of teams that were like that, and it's a bad place to be. I mean, it's just guys aren't doing. You want to have a team where guys are going that extra little edge, whether it's helping other guys out, whether it's working after practice, all that, all the time, and just geeking out on football. And I think that's one of the reasons that these guys like Brandon Cook so much. I think he's a bit of a football geek.
Going through practice yesterday, going through my observations, Seth, we know Zach Cunningham is on the verge of getting a big contract here at some point. We know Bill O'Brien loves him. He expressed that love for Cunningham last week. We know the Achilles heel with Cunningham right now, if there is one, is he could be better in pass coverage. He had a good practice in pass coverage yesterday. One-on-one drills against David Johnson. He had a pass breakup. He had another pass breakup during 11-on-11. There were some. Cunningham's had a really good camp. Like, he just doing the Zach Cunningham things that got him nearly to a Pro Bowl last year. He is doing all of those things, but yesterday he had a pretty good practice in pass coverage as well. So optimism for me, Zach Cunningham. Green arrow up on pass coverage, Zach Cunningham.
Yeah, that's really the one last step he needs to take, because over the second half of last season especially, he showed how good his football instincts were, and he showed like his ability to come up and make plays at great speed. Remember, this is a guy that in college, the knock on him was that he wasn't a good tackler. And he got here and you saw that a little bit. He'd get to the point of where the tackle should be a lot and then just falter the last few moments. He worked on it and he's gotten a whole lot better at that. And I think with pass coverage, that's where it is too. A little bit of it has just been recognizing routes, anticipating where the ball carry is going to be. Also, knowing what you're allowed to get away with over the middle. You know, inside linebackers can get away. They can push the envelope on that 5 yards of contact or 5 yards of no contact a little bit. And smart inside linebackers know how to do that. The Texans last year did not grade out well at all in covering passes over the middle of intermediate area of the field, right where the linebackers are. That's one thing that's just got to change this year if they want to be a genuinely competitive team.
Offensively for this team, Seth, we've been talking about, okay, what can Fuller and Cooks do for each other with all that speed? Boy, Randall Cobb, a slot receiver working the middle of the field, it's pretty exciting. David Johnson is a really good pass catcher for a running back, so is Duke Johnson. We may just be looking at all these different weapons on the outside and in the backfield and missing what might be the guy who's at the best camp on the offensive side of the ball other than Deshaun Watson. Jordan Akins was incredible again on Sunday. He had a catch and run on a tight end screen that was really, really nice, and he had a catch down the seam where it was an athletic play. It was not one of these plays that was designed. He gets open, there's a busted coverage, and he catches the ball, and it's a 30-yard catch for Jordan Akins. And it shows up in the box score that way. Whoever threw it to him, I think it was Deshaun, because Akins has been playing pretty much exclusively with Deshaun, threw it a little high. He sailed it a little bit. Akins went up and got this ball. It was an athletic play. Jordan Akins is having a really good camp, and if we're talking about how all this speed is going to open up the field for guys, Akins has got to be on that short list of guys who could see their game in year two to year three take a jump here.
He needs to do two things. He either has to be good enough to overcome the fact that his blocking isn't as good as it should be, or he needs to become a better blocker. Mm-hmm. And then he's if you can be Travis Kelce, who can't block a lick and has no interest in it, it doesn't matter if you're that good as a receiver. So I'm not gonna worry about that. I would like Jordan Thomas to be the kind of blocker that he looks like he should be. You know, Jordan Thomas looks like he could play offensive tackle if he set his mind to it.
He used to be a wide receiver in college.
Yeah, I know.
That's a crazy
thing,
yeah.
But he's big enough. You see him in person, oh, yeah. It's like, okay, this guy could put on 20 pounds and be an offensive tackle. So I'd like to see him progress as a blocker, too. But just Jordan Akins being a genuine downfield threat as a wide receiver or as a receiving tight end alone, I'll accept that if he improves in that. But the dream is that he become a complete blocker and pass catcher.
All right, those are five or six observations from practice. I've got about 9 or 10 of them up on sportsradio610.com. You can find the full report there. I wanted to make sure we had at least a few minutes to discuss what was, Seth, probably the biggest story nationally in the NFL yesterday was the Baltimore Ravens releasing Earl Thomas. And immediately speculation going to where he may go. For those who aren't up to speed on the story, Earl Thomas got into a fight with a teammate at practice the other day. It feels like this was a straw that broke the camel's back situation for the Ravens, and it does feel like the Ravens have no desire to pay him his $10 million guaranteed this year. So they cut him for conduct detrimental to the team. They're going to go after his money. The players' union is going to file a grievance to try to get his money. That'll take plenty of time to work out. Seth, if I'm a team that's assessing bringing Earl Thomas onto my roster, how much factors in that the Baltimore Ravens leadership committee went to John Harbaugh and said, we don't want this guy on our team anymore?
That's a huge, 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 huge thing. And I think when you combine that with the altercations he's had with teammates, not just this most recent fight that he had with a fellow defensive back, a fellow safety, which this fight happened because Earl Thomas decided to blitz when he wasn't supposed to blitz, and the receiver he was supposed to be covering caught a ball downfield. That's why that fight happened. He got an altercation last year with the nose tackle, Brandon Williams, because Earl Thomas went to him and said that he should have suited up for the game, but Brandon Williams was out because he was injured. That was on a play, by the way. Okay, that was the game, September 29th, 2019. Baltimore was down 6 points in the fourth quarter to the Browns. Earl Thomas gave up chasing running back Nick Chubb on an 88-yard touchdown.
Oh, I remember that.
He explained that he didn't want to pull a hamstring. So after that, he goes in and then confronts nose tackle Brandon Williams about not suiting up for the game because of injury concerns. So there's an altercation with a teammate.
Yep.
October 21st. Earl Thomas didn't return with the Ravens on the team flight back to Baltimore. Then he chose to take the entire bye week off, blowing off meetings on Monday and Tuesday. And so, this paints a picture of a really erratic journey from the time Earl Thomas in Seattle told everybody that he wasn't going to practice if he wasn't feeling good. You know, anything as minor as a headache or anything. To when he finally got injured and flipped off Pete Carroll as he was exiting the field. To all this stuff that's happened, to this latest altercation with a teammate, and then the team leadership council saying that they didn't want Earl Thomas back. Any team that signs Earl Thomas with any amount of guaranteed money is just basically peeing into the wind at that point. I think you've got to have a very heavily incentive based deal, and you got to figure out what's going on in Earl Thomas's brain that's causing him to behave like this.
Well, he's had a really weird 18 months, Seth. You just outlined the things that went on in the building with the Ravens. There was that altercation with his wife this offseason where she pulled a gun on him and his brother because he was having an extramarital affair. He was involved in some group thing with his brother that was really strange.
Do you call it an affair? I mean, he and his brother met some ladies on social media and they were going to have a dalliance. I don't know if it was an ongoing affair.
Is affair a more invested sort of long-term thing?
I'm not saying that's better or worse or anything. I'm just saying, for the sake of accuracy. So his wife and her friends showed up, packing heat, right?
The most Seth Kane thing ever. You want to debate semantics of an orgy versus an affair.
That sounds like a Lance Armstrong denial. Hey, I never had an affair.
Right?
I never had an affair.
There were other people in the room. It's impossible for it to be an affair by definition. So he had that. If you look at the way he ended in Seattle, where he breaks his leg and as he's getting carted off the field, he has the presence of mind to make sure he flips off the entire sideline as he's leaving the field in Seattle back 2 years ago.
Now, Texans fans' ears perked up or eyebrows raised when they saw Deshaun Watson tweet out, "Surprised the Ravens released my guy Earl Thomas. Hearing all the noise, but Earl's always been someone I can rely on when I had questions, and I have nothing but respect for him. Can't wait to see where he lands." Don't read too much into that. Deshaun Watson and Earl Thomas share an agent, David Mugoletta, he commands a fierce amount of loyalty from his clients. He's done a really impressive job. Like, this is a guy that's kind of built himself up from nowhere. And I think Earl Thomas was his first client. They knew each other at University of Texas. And Mugoletta knew Earl Thomas when he was an undergrad. And I think Mugoletta was in law school at the time. I wouldn't read that necessarily as Deshaun Watson clamoring for Earl Thomas. I think that's a little bit of maybe agent solidarity there. And also just having a genuine friendship with Earl Thomas.
How do you explain Justin Reed liking Deshaun Watson's tweet?
Okay.
Reed, not a Mulligetta client.
I would say I don't want to mispronounce. It is Mugoletta, right? Okay. Okay, this is how it has to work. If the Texans were to have their leadership council or veterans work together, it would have to be, they can't be Mugoletta clients. It's got to be guys like Justin Reed and all these other guys that get to talk to Earl Thomas and say, all right, what's going on? Because by the way, we had a guy who came from Baltimore a few years back by the name of Ed Reed, who also wasn't necessarily as much of a fit as people thought they were. I don't want another Ed Reed situation, Sean. I flat out don't. Look, in Earl Thomas, he's a great player. He had one interception last year. It was not as smooth a transition as they would have hoped for. They had to, figure out exactly how to use him while he was there. This is not a slam dunk. Oh, it's A. Earl Thomas. They'll go to the Super Bowl if they sign him.
Seth Payne had a moment in Nick Martin's Zoom press conference yesterday. We actually learned which piece of equipment Martin stole from, borrowed from the Texans gym. We'll hear that next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.